It's this Focus 580, hour number two of the show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Kyle Mabry's at the controls this morning. He's laughing in there. Glad to have him here and glad to have you listening. And we're also pleased to have back on the program once again Brian Johnson. He is an associate professor of journalism here at the U of I. A longtime photographer, guy before he started teaching journalism. He worked for the local paper here as a photographer. And every once in a while, he's here on this program when we talk about taking pictures. And certainly the technology of picture taking has changed a lot over the years we've been doing this. I think of the very first times we talked about digital photography, and it was a very high-end thing. The equipment was really expensive. It was pros who were using it.
Right.
And now... it pretty much everybody's using digital cameras.
It's almost the only thing you can use. Hey, I have to correct one thing.
Oh, I'm sorry. What?
I've been promoted.
Ladies and gentlemen, he's been promoted.
I'm now a professor.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I did not know. He is a professor. He's a professor of journalism.
So I've always, professed things, but now it's official.
Now it's official. All right. Well, for people who are listening this morning, if you have questions about photography, cameras, lenses, if you still want to talk about film, you want to talk about digital, whatever.
Yeah.
That's great.
You know, the prices, you mentioned the prices at the top, and it's just so incredible how far things have dropped. I bought some 2 gigabyte memory cards for student cameras, and I paid $5.50 a piece for them, which is like nothing,
like
really,
nothing.
So, you can get a really decent digital camera for, $100, $125, $145. It's incredible.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I was thinking about having you talk about was kind of like that. I was thinking that it wasn't all that long ago that having 5 megapixels was a big, was huge.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now you can get 10.
I know. Well, in fact, in cleaning out my lab, I'm coming across all these generations of equipment. So there's the generation of film cameras I had before I got, a newer generation of film cameras. So it went from manual to auto exposure and autofocus, which, I still would teach the manual stuff, but those are there. Then it went to my first digital camera, which I think was $1,000. It was a 0.6 megapixel. It was a 0.6. It was 640. Yeah, it was 640 by 480 pixels.
Wow.
And, and all the way up. And, it's kind of like, those early cameras you're paying $700, $800 for, and they were 2 megapixel cameras, 2.6, and the progression up. Now, we should talk about this, though, because something that you don't really hear the manufacturers talking about very much is the size of the imaging sensor, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about that before, but it's really becoming an issue. You can put 12 million little individual spots on a 1/2 inch sensor, but that's not as good as having a sensor that's larger and having that same number of megapixels. So the megapixel count of the camera isn't everything. You also really should be looking at how large is that image sensor.
And what would you suggest people look for?
It basically, the bigger, the better. Some of the smaller cameras, they have they have basically like a 1/2 inch size sensor. That's pretty common size. Some of them are even smaller, a 1/3 of an inch, a 1/4 of an inch. So that's one thing that you should look for.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So don't completely go with
the megapixels. Right. And, there are things we can talk about later about, how well the camera records images in low light and how quick the autofocus works and things like that.
Well, we can talk about some of those things too, but I have some callers here who'd like to ask their own questions. We'll do that. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. El Paso is next, or first, here on line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have several Adobe Photoshop questions, a number of them for Brian.
Okay.
I have just purchased the Photoshop 6, and I have not loaded it into a computer yet. I have, I'm new to this. I have several computers, and I've looked closely at the licensing agreement and such, and I cannot find out if I can put it on more than one computer. And then another related question I had was I had this idea of buying an external hard drive. They're available now for about $100 with a lot of capacity.
Right.
And I thought, well, maybe I could put it on that and then store my photos on there with it and then use it with whatever computer I wanted to. I don't know if that's feasible.
Right,
or
sure.
Not.
Well, normally the licensing agreements say you can load it on one computer. Some of the educational licenses will say that a professor can have one copy on his school computer and one copy on his or her home computer.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes manufacturers will sell a family pack of software so you can, you know, load it on three or five, but normally it's just one. Now, your idea about the external hard drive is interesting because I guess it would depend on how many files the program is installing on the system disk. So,
yeah, I have no experience with a hard drive, but I've seen them. They're advertised like at Office Depot and places.
Right. It's time. Yeah, and that's another place where prices have really plummeted. There's I bought some hard drives for a multimedia class that we're running, and it was a 500 gigabyte external drive. It runs off of USB connection.
Yeah.
And it was $90.
Correct.
$90 for 500 gigabytes, and it's mind-boggling.
Now, do those only work with the USB 2 or the older USB, whatever they called those?
Yeah, USB 1. But, you know, if you only have a USB 1 connection, you really don't want to run a hard drive off of it because you're going to pull your hair out. You're going to pull your eyelashes out.
Oh, sure. But you don't know for sure if I could get one of those and then load my Adobe program into it.
Yeah, I'm going to guess that there are files that it loads on the system disk of your computer, which basically makes it illegal. So I think if you're a strict adherent to the licensing agreements, I don't believe they allow you to have it on more than one machine.
Okay. Next question I have regarding that, Brian, is I'm sure there's a number of how to do it books out there for Photoshop 6. Do you have any one in particular for an amateur? You know, and I'm working by myself, or I wouldn't have anybody to really ask questions of.
Right, right.
What would be a good book to start with?
You know, there's a series of books called the Visual Guide to Learning the Software, and this will sound maybe kind of crazy in a way, but what I do is I go to the bookstore and I go to the Photoshop section and I pull out two or three books and I look at how they are explaining things. I look at how they're using pictures. You know, do they have color pictures of the little palettes that pop up, or are they just black and white? And many times there'll be, two excellent books, but I'll just prefer one over the other because of how they're explaining things.
Uh-huh.
I'm also a Macintosh user, so if there's one book that's using, the PC screenshots and one that's using the Macintosh screenshots, I'll, even though they're almost identical, I'll still go with the Macintosh screenshot. So, there's no shortage of books, but I think it really pays for you to, look at two or three of them, look at some of the exercises or the examples that they're showing and see if the way they're wording those examples makes sense to you.
Okay.
And that's really the best way, I think, to go about it.
Sure. I got one other question that might be of interest to a number of digital photographers, and I've read a little bit about in picture quality and stuff, and they talk about noise in a digital photograph. And what does that mean, Brian?
Right. So if you were going to enlarge your photo and you look at it, it looks kind of speckly. They're like little dots. Sometimes they're little sort of black dots. Sometimes they're red, green, and blue dots kind of scattered around the photo. And that's basically an artifact of the imaging chip trying to do its job under not perfect conditions. You know, usually in a low light situation, or if you have the ISO set up really high, you'll start to get a lot more of that noise. It's kind of like in the old days with film when we had grain. You know, higher speed films had more grain.
Sure.
It isn't the exact same thing, but it's a good analogy to think about.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the help.
Sure.
Well, thank you. Our guest this morning in this Barna Focus 580, Brian Johnson. He's a professor of journalism at the University of Illinois and has got a lot of experience with cameras and photography. That's what he teaches. And every once in a while he's here, and that's what we talk about. We have several callers. Others welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Next is somebody in Savoy. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Thank you for being on the program. I have a digital camera that I like really well, except that it's slow. Is there any way? I mean, it's Nikon. Coolpix.
Right, and what does it do? Because you cut out just a little bit, as you're saying.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's slow. I mean, it doesn't seem that I can speed up the.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Or let it, expose for a longer time.
Right.
Or something.
Right. So when you say that it's slow, do you mean when you take? You press the button, it, takes the picture, yeah. And then it takes a while.
No, that I understand. But
okay.
The other, I would like, to be able to open the aperture or something going back to film cameras, but I don't know how you do that in a digital if you need to get more megapixels.
Right.
Because this one is pretty good as far as megapixels,
yeah.
Megapixels are concerned.
Right. Most of the cameras have, I shouldn't say most, but, in the kind of low medium range, the very, very cheapest
yeah.
ones. Actually, I bought a camera at Toys R Us for $24.95.
Really?
Yeah. So you can get them.
You have to go there and get one.
Yeah, it has no features except for a shutter button, basically.
Okay, well, that's all they need.
But if you want to make some of the settings, a lot of the cameras have a manual setting.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to go through the menus.
Okay. I don't think it does.
Some of the cameras are also, some of the cheaper cameras have slower computers inside of the cameras because really these digital cameras all have a little computer built into them.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes those are slower and they take a longer time to process information. They take a longer time to, register the input from the photographer.
Is there any way I can speed it up on this camera?
Yeah. Something I've done, and it's not practical in all situations, but sometimes I've noticed that if I put the camera in manual focus so that, it doesn't have to look for whether the image is in focus or not. If I can set a manual exposure, I set that so then it doesn't, it's not trying to do a meter reading. Some of those things, as I say, they aren't that practical in many situations, but in some, they can help speed things up a little bit.
I just looked at the image mode, and it's got high, normal PC TV screen.
Yeah.
If I'm normal, should I go to, if I went to high, would that be faster, do you think?
With the high, I'm guessing that it might be more geared towards action things, sports and things like that.
Yeah.
It may be faster, but I suspect it's not necessarily faster. It's just how it's setting the exposures.
Okay. All righty. Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you. Next, let's talk with someone in Urbana. Line two. Hello.
Hello. I have two questions about my digital camera that I love. I love my camera, but it's 6 years old. And it's been working well until one day when all I had on the that I could see on the screen was black.
Uh-huh.
And I've been told that means that the sensor is gone, no longer works, and that there's no way to really replace that I just have to get
right.
a new camera.
Right.
You'd concur with
yeah.
that?
Yeah. Now, the one thing I'll ask you to look into, on some of the cameras, many of them, you can turn the display on or off.
Yeah.
And I don't know if, you know, you have any thought that you might have inadvertently actually just turned the screen off at some point, and maybe that's all it is. Because, you know, I know on most of my cameras, if I want to save battery power or something, you know, I'll turn the display off.
Oh, I see. And then you just look through the viewfinder? Is that what you mean?
Right, right.
Okay.
And,
well, even when I look through the viewfinder, it's black.
Okay. Well,
so it's done, huh?
If you have, you know, fresh batteries in it and it's actually turning on and it's not doing anything. Now, I think one thing that you're going to be, you know, pleasantly surprised about, though, is the amount of camera, the amount of functionality you'll be able to get. For the same price you paid 6 years ago for that camera, you know, your head will spin practically on, you know, what's available for that same price.
Right. Yes, that is a good thing, and I'm looking forward to that. But my second question now is, in terms of our environmental footprint, what are we doing with our old broken cameras?
You know, and it's not just the cameras. I think about the inkjet printers that you get for free that you pay $60 for, and then, you know, the ink costs $80, so you don't use it anymore. That's something that really needs to be done nationwide, I think. We need to have a better way to recycle electronics.
Yeah.
You know, it's also a big issue with cell phones because people sign up, they get a new cell phone, and there it goes. And you think, oh, a cell phone is small. Oh, a digital camera is small. But it does all add up, and, you know, it'd be great if it could be recycled.
Right.
Some of the manufacturers are using they're using plastics that can be more easily recycled. One thing Apple Computer is going to is they're using LED lights to light up their monitors rather than fluorescent tubes. So there are things like that you can do. But I think Champaign-Urbana had an electronics recycling day.
Not very long ago.
No, right, exactly. It was like a couple months ago, and it's sort of a once-a-year affair, right?
Yeah, so I think
I understand that people who went were just online for hours.
Yes, that's it. And, you know, that's why I'm 100% with you here that it needs to be done as a matter of policy because it's only going to get worse.
Right. The only thing I can think of is to, as long as there's nothing hazardous, is to let children use them for dramatic play in preschools and stuff.
Right, right, right. And the other thing that I've done is I've used them so that they can take them apart and look at how they're constructed.
Yes,
inside.
That's an excellent idea.
One thing I'll warn all the listeners out there about, though, is that if the camera has a pop-up flash unit in it, they have basically it's an energy storing device. It kind of looks like a battery, but those can maintain their charge for a very, very long time.
Oh.
And if you – I was taking apart a disposable camera that had a flash built in, and I got quite a jolt by touching it. And this is a camera that hadn't been used for quite a while. So it's something to be very cautious about because that is something that could be a little bit dangerous inside.
Right. Well, thank you, and congratulations on your promotion.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. I think it's a really – the caller makes a really good point that and you do as well, is that we really need a way to deal with consumer electronics.
Right.
Because nowadays, you know, stuff is built so that basically nobody fixes stuff anymore.
Absolutely. And it's also batteries, too. I mean, that's – now, you know, I'm gratified that I know at Best Buy, for instance, and I know other places do it as well, but they right as you walk in, they have this cart kind of where you can drop off batteries and cell phones and all that. And I hope we see more of that.
Yeah, because, when stuff wears out – and now in the conversion to digital TV, eventually over the period of a few years, there are a lot of people who are going to be getting rid of television sets because they're not going to do
it
anymore. They want something better.
And especially if they're a tube TV, there's, you know, lead and a lot of, you know, metals in those picture tubes that we really want to recycle.
I think that's on the last consumer electronics recycling thing that we had here. I think that was part of the deal why there were so many people. There were people who were getting rid of their old television
sets. And I know at some places, I don't know if we did it here, but At some places, you can recycle most stuff for free, but for TVs and monitors, there's a charge of $15 or $20, yeah. which is still cheap.
But. Yeah. Well, let's go and talk with some more folks here. Next will be someone in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I think I have a possible workaround for the first person and a comment and a question.
Okay.
I think some operating systems will permit booting from an external hard drive.
Right.
So put the operating system on the hard drive, on the external hard drive, and you should be able to get all the files on that drive.
Right, yeah. And as long as the other computers will work with whatever version of the system you install, yeah, that is a really good solution.
Of course, if you have one Mac and one PC, that's probably not going to work. But a comment, my hands aren't as steady as they used to be, so I simply put my digital camera in sports mode if I'm not using a monopod.
Sure.
And that seems to, I think it's getting a 1/1000th of a second exposure, and I'm taking mostly botanical pictures, but it works pretty well.
Yeah, a couple other things. Many of the cameras have image stabilization built in.
The next one I get will.
Yeah, and, as you're looking at those, there are two types of image stabilization. One is an optical image stabilization where it actually moves one of the lens elements in an opposite direction to the way you're shaking. And then the other is electronic stabilization. Some cameras actually have both, and they use them in conjunction. One is to stop, the subject movement. One is more for the camera movement.
I also was wondering if you would compare Photoshop and GIMP.
Yeah, it's funny because you don't really hear much about people using GIMP anymore for photos. I think, back in the early days, you would hear, more about that. But anymore, I think the software is advanced enough that it can handle things. Somewhat on the same thought process, not exactly, but somewhat on the same thought process is that the slightly higher-end cameras can shoot in a mode that's called RAW. So instead of creating a JPEG image, what it does is either shoots a RAW or keeps the RAW file that you can download, or it does a RAW and a JPEG both. It opens up a huge door for what you can do with the image. Because basically what you're doing in the RAW mode is you're just taking the data from the camera. It isn't. Mm-hmm. It hasn't been processed in any way, and then you can basically do all the processing in your computer program. So, I would think for someone like you that's working with botanical images, that shooting in RAW would be a really awesome way to get the highest quality images from your work.
And you don't think GIMP would load a RAW image?
I don't know, just because I haven't. It's been a while since I've really even thought about it. Something you also might want to do is start shooting with a tripod.
I use a monopod or a tripod.
Yeah, because so often, it used to be with film cameras, everyone thought, oh, I've got a camera and now I need a tripod. Well, so tripods have kind of fallen out of favor, and especially with image stabilization, but a tripod can do wonders, and mm-hmm. A company that I like for tripods is Manfrotto.
I have one.
Okay, and they have this new tripod out that's, like $50,
mm-hmm.
And it's very lightweight, easy to carry, but yet it seems pretty functional, so that might be, I'm glad to hear that you're using a tripod as well as the monopod whenever it seems to work.
What was it? I had other question that you brought up. What was it now? The next time you're on, maybe I'll remember.
Okay,
or
you can
much.
Call
All
back.
Right.
Okay,
very
great. Thanks.
Let's go on here to Champagne, line 1. Hello.
Hi. I actually just have one comment. I'm really enjoying the show, learning a lot. But regarding the woman who called in and her screen went black.
Yes.
On her digital camera. mine did the exact same thing, and I was so tempted. Again, I love my camera, but I was tempted to go and get another camera. However, it still takes pictures.
Okay.
The pictures are still as beautiful. Yes, I'm using the viewfinder versus the little LCD screen.
Right.
But the camera works perfectly fine.
Great.
So I didn't have to pitch it.
Yeah, you know, and it seemed like from the brief conversation we had that on her camera she might have had also an electronic viewfinder, which was also dark.
Okay.
So, but you're exactly right that, you know, it could be just that, you know, the screen is dead and
right.
that the sensor's there. And so right. I would try it and
okay.
see if, yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah,
very
absolutely.
Good. Thank you. Okay, here we go. Next, another champagne person, line number two.
Yes. This is maybe a really simple question, but I was overseas on research, and I teach a lot of culture classes, culture-related classes over at the university, and I picked up a Sanyo camcorder when I was over there, and I took a lot of, actually a film also. It also takes regular digital pictures and so on. What I'm wondering is if I teach in a large, if I use a large sort of, if I project it largely, will, on a large screen, let's say, it will the image come out reasonably clear? Or would there be a diminution of the quality?
Right. You know, it's something that I was planning on bringing up during the day today, that a lot of the cameras now have a movie mode that's equal in quality to normal digital video or a mini DV camera that you would have had. So for instance, you know, several of the cameras now, they'll record an image that's 640 pixels by 480 pixels at 30 pictures per second, which basically is just normal digital video resolution. So yeah, it's pretty incredible that you can, you know, for the videos, you can project them. And even for the photos, it's pretty amazing, especially when the people who are looking at the image aren't sitting right up on top of it. You know, they're in a normal classroom situation.
The reason why I was curious about it, I picked up a few years back, I'd spent like $500 on this, you know, digital camera, and it would take some moving pictures, moving images, and it was. I realized once I got this camcorder how utterly distinct the quality was. But the camcorder is extremely good, and I was only really worried about this issue of projection and whether there would be any problems. So that's very good to hear.
Yeah.
I don't remember the pixels, but it's pretty high.
No, I think you'll be happy with the way it looks.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. And line number three. This is Urbana. Hello.
Hi. First, let me preface my remarks by saying that I'm a Mac user.
Yay.
Steve Jobs would be very happy.
Rah, rah, rah.
Right.
A year and a half ago, I bought an external hard drive to use to back up the stuff on my Mac.
Right.
I bought a 250-gig hard drive. I paid about $150 for it. And I'm very disappointed. Let me tell you why. When I start to download stuff, I will often get things will simply stop, and I'll get a message saying, file title too long. And so I've got to go back and manually find out what file you're talking about and mess around with it and so on. Is that simply an artifact of the one that I bought, or is there some protocol that I'm violating, or what's going on?
Right. What it could be is that the way a lot of the external hard drives are formatted is really they're formatted for a PC. And on the Macintosh side, what you should do when you first get the drive and you plug it in, you should go to Disk Utility and reformat the drive. It takes but, you know, 10 seconds to do, really, because there's nothing on the drive and it just, you know, kind of changes what the format is. And I think that's probably exactly what's happened to you.
Okay. So there is a provision for formatting it for Macs?
Right. Right. Okay. You know, and as I say, it doesn't seem like that big of a deal until, you know, you run into some issues like that. So, you know, if you had a way for you to copy all the content that's on that drive, or if it's just backed up information, you could just reformat it as a Mac and then copy everything back onto
okay.
it.
Very good. I'll try to do that.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Sure. We're a little bit past our midpoint here. Brian Johnson is our guest. He's professor of journalism at the U of I, teaches photojournalism for a long time. Occasionally, he stopped by here. We talk about cameras and picture taking and try to answer people's questions. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. And again, here we'll go next, talk somebody in Champaign. Line number one. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
First, a little tree-hugging comment. I definitely agree that we need to recycle waste better, but I'm not sure we're serving a purpose by putting it in containers and shipping it off to third-world countries to be smelted. But anyhow, my question is, why don't cameras like the little Canon that I love come with something like an old-fashioned connection so you could use a cable release along with a tripod or a monopod?
Right. Some of the cameras have, you know, a bulb setting that you can use. Some of them have very are you interested in mostly long exposures or just the fact that you want to have a remote?
Well, I was thinking about the person that called in with somewhat shaky hands and so forth, and even with a tripod or a monopod.
Right.
If you're going to be shaking as you hit the shutter button, it'd be nice to have an old-fashioned
right
where you weren't touching the camera.
And there's one little trick that I always tell my students about is that you can use the self-timer on the camera. And many cameras will have a self-timer that you can set to go off in 2 seconds after you press the shutter button or 10 seconds.
Well, that's a great idea.
Yeah. And so, you know, you set it to 2 seconds, you press the button, you move away from it. Some of the other cameras, and I haven't seen this be quite as available lately, but in the earlier days of digital cameras, a lot of them came with a remote control. So you could, you know, point it at the camera and press the button to take the picture. So,
yeah, well, it is fascinating, and I have friends that have the studio lines of digital cameras.
Right.
So I lust for those.
I understand that.
Yeah, but my little Canon is just a great little camera.
Absolutely. And, you know, something, you know, on that last topic, I was downloading some photos to my computer. You know, always there are several ways you can load it directly into an image management program like iPhoto, you know, usually there are some other programs. In Apple's case, they have one called Image Capture. That's a pretty straightforward, you know, get the pictures into the computer program. One thing I noticed about it, though, there's a button on that when your camera's connected, there was a take picture button. And I don't think that was in earlier versions of Image Capture, but regardless, I didn't notice it. So I was playing with that. And that becomes kind of a cable release in a way, although you need your camera connected to the computer to make that work.
Yep. Well, just a curious question.
Yeah, no, it's good.
I'm sure the higher-end studio cameras have cable releases and obviously all kinds of shutter mechanisms.
Right. Yes, they do.
It would be nice if they were available on the smaller cameras, too.
Right.
Well, thank you for your comments.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Great, thank you.
Bye.
We'll talk next with someone in Sycamore. Line number four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to one of your original comments you made as the program opened about imaging device size.
Right.
And it occurs to me that the same rules for film apply here, that if you have a larger imaging surface, you're going to be less susceptible to dust.
Right.
And you're also going to have a shallower depth of field, and you're going to require lenses with larger covering power.
Right. Exactly. And you know, it's definitely a trade-off, but most of the professional cameras that photojournalists would be using, for instance, you know, there are some full-size sensors. So what that means, it's the same size as a piece of 35-millimeter film used to be. You know, for some of the studio cameras, some of the portrait cameras, they have sensors that are just as big as, you know, a 2.25 square piece of film used to be. So, and, you know, some of those...
That's a big piece of silicon.
It is, and some of those camera backs sell for $20,000 and $30,000 because it's so big. But But you're absolutely right that as you change the size of the sensor, it does impact the lens and the depth of field and all those other issues.
Okay, my last question for you, and I'll listen off there then, is have they yet come up with a replacement in digital for the 8x10 view camera? Thank you.
Okay. It is amazing on some of these higher ends or some of the experimental ends that there are imaging sensors that are large. Now, I can't say that I've investigated them and seen them, you know, as large as 8x10. I would not be surprised at all that they're there, but I've seen, some that are getting up there in size. They get very expensive, certainly at that size. Some of it is, too, is that with a larger sensor and the, density of the pixels that it can register, we're getting some really high-resolution images, even though the sensor might not be the exact size of an 8x10 piece of film. But, again, we can get some images with that same kind of resolution.
Well, we were talking about this before, and maybe we should take a couple of minutes here, and I hope that we have a couple of callers here that they wouldn't mind hanging on for just a second. But we did talk about that at the beginning of the program. That is, when you're thinking about buying a camera, one of the things you're going to look at is megapixels.
Right.
And that's really the number of megapixels that you can get. It's really gone up now. And then you said, well, yeah, that's something to think about, but you also want to think about how big is the image sensor
right
in the camera. So that's another thing. What, generally, okay, if you're going out to look at a camera, what sort of things should people be thinking
about? Right. And a lot of this is going to be an issue of how much money do I have to spend, and a trade-off of the of a certain category of point and shoot. If it's on the lower end, it's going to have a smaller sensor. Mm-hmm. If it's going to be in the middle end, it'll have a higher megapixel count, and it may have a larger sensor. Not by much. I mean, it could be the difference between, a third of an inch sensor or a half of an inch sensor. But usually the manufacturers are looking at whatever everyone else is doing, and they have them almost in classes. This is our low end, so it's going to have a quarter inch sensor. This is, a little bit better. But usually what you have to do is you have to click on the specifications tab. So if you're looking at the camera manufacturer's website, or if you're looking at, the website for a store, it's not just going to be advertised, now with a half inch, sensor size, because they know that, people are chasing after the megapixels. So what you need to do is click on the specifications and then see what it says for that sensor size. Something tied in with this, it isn't so much about the image sensor itself, but with the mechanics of the camera. I was doing a demonstration in my photo class recently, and I always do this experiment where they're learning how whatever they're pointing the camera at affects what the exposure is. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, now set, we had our cameras on manual, now set your camera to this setting. Well, the smallest size aperture that the camera had was only f/8. Now, they always tell you what the largest aperture is, which for a lot of these cameras will be, 2.8 or 3.5. Sometimes it'll be 4.0. Okay, well, that's a great selling point, because the larger the aperture size, the lower the light level you can shoot more easily. But a lot of these cameras are limited in their range of apertures. So if they only have, four apertures or five apertures, it gets back to what the caller was asking about, the image size and how that affects your depth of field. With a lot of these smaller sensors, it's hard to get that shallow depth of field look. So if I was taking a portrait of someone and I wanted the background blurred, well, sometimes you have to really know what you're doing to make that effect happen with some of the smaller cameras. Hmm. So as they've made them less expensive, they combine the shutter mechanism and the aperture mechanism, and then that limits the range of apertures that you get. They might still have a fairly large aperture, but you can't go to a smaller aperture to get a lot of depth of field maybe. And I suppose they figure, well, they're getting so much depth of field because of the type of lens we have, that's not an issue, but to have those range of exposure choices can affect you if you are someone who knows what those different settings can do. For the average user, you know what? It's not an issue, and almost all the cameras have the simple setting. Canon always, you know, makes theirs a green setting, and you put it in that mode, and it does everything for you. And in fact, it won't let you do some things because they're saying, you know, we don't want you to mess up, so we're not we're going to save you from yourself. So,
okay. Well, we have a couple other callers here. We're trying to make sure we get them in, and they are both in Champaign, and the first person is line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, hello. My question is what is a good video camera?
Okay, well that's a really great question. There's been a lot that's been happening with cameras and video cameras. Many of the regular cameras you might shoot to take a picture now can also do really excellent video as well. And so what you're seeing is a video camera that does great video but can also take some regular still pictures and some still cameras that can also shoot video. They're all kind of coming together to the point where there are some regular picture-taking cameras that will actually record in high definition. So that was an excellent question.
Well, yeah, it was, Dad.
I knew it was you, Alex.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. If you're going to do that, say that you have a camera that's primarily they're thinking you're going to take still photos,
right?
But will also take some. How much of a time period will it do that?
Right.
For?
Well, you can buy if you have enough money, you can buy a 32 gigabyte memory card for your camera. Those are still fairly pricey, but you can buy a 16 gigabyte card. I've seen some of those for around $100 maybe. Well, you can record, 35 or 40 minutes. Well, let's see, with a 16 gigabyte, you should be able to record about an hour's worth of video.
Oh.
And in the old days with the still cameras, they recorded sort of an itsy-bitsy little movie,
Right.
And I used to scoff at that. It's like, well, why bother? But then I realized, okay, well, you should think about it as if it were a picture that moves. So a still picture that has movement in it. Well, now it's to the point where the video mode on most of the still cameras is just normal digital video. It has as high quality as a mini DV video camera would.
Yeah.
So where do you go? I mean, I think, think what you want to do. Are you mostly interested in doing video? Then get the video camera. If you're mostly going to do stills, get that. And that's going to make your decision for you.
Yeah. Well, that's I'm impressed that it would do that because I'm going back to the time thinking that, yes, you had a camera primarily was going to do still shots and it would do some video. But how long would it take? Like a minute or something?
Right.
Oh, so what yeah. I thought would be, well, what is the
– What's the use of it?
What's the use of that?
Right, exactly. Some of the cameras like Canon, some of the models that they have out now, they were limited to only – shooting a video as long as 4 gigabytes would give you. That would still be, a good, 12 to 15 minute chunk. You could shoot more than on the rest of the card. But that limitation's going away where if you have a, 16 gigabyte card or 32 gigabyte card, you can just go straight through and, record video. There are even, digital video cameras out now where, yes, we've had cameras that have recorded on a little hard drive. Yes, we've had cameras that have recorded on kind of a mini DVD. But the newer cameras that are out, they're recording right on to a memory card. So, what's so cool about that is there really aren't many moving parts left in the camera anymore.
Uh-huh. All right. Let's see. We have some other callers here. Another Champaign person, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Need to back up a couple of generations here.
Okay.
What's the best way to clean glass plate negatives?
Wow. Well, thing number one, I would be sure that you do not clean the side of the glass where the image is. And so I'd be very careful that the emulsion side is something that you're not touching. When I'm cleaning lenses, what I like to use is actually isopropyl alcohol. I put a little bit of that on a lens cleaning tissue, and that works pretty well. I'd be very careful that you test that if, you know, maybe you have one of the glass negatives that accidentally was dropped or is really scratched up, and, you know, you can see how that affects it. But, yeah, be really careful that the side that the image is actually recorded on doesn't get touched. And the other side, I would think alcohol would work, but maybe someone out there knows better than I do.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, all absolutely.
Right. Thank you. Line two, Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I am not a photographer at all, but I'm kind of backed into thinking I need a digital camera.
Uh-huh.
It'll be only for this, and I let the rest of the family take the pictures.
Sure.
And I'm a landlord, and it's very good to go in and take a bunch of pictures before and after someone moves in to, you know,
right.
determine damage.
Right.
And so I need detail, like, you know, did you put scotch tape on the wall that peeled the paint off?
Right.
Did you pound a hole in the wall and that kind of thing? And pictures of the oven to see if it's clean. So I need pretty much detail. But that's all.
Sure. Well, you are in luck because a lot of the digital cameras now also have a built-in macro mode so mm-hmm. that you can get close-up. Now, on the Canon, and other cameras have a button very similar to this, on the Canon, they indicate the macro mode. There's a little flower icon. So you can either shoot in mountain mode, which is, you know, kind of normal mode, or flower mode, which is kind of the close-up mode. And it's incredible because actually I was looking at the specifications of a camera the other day, and it could record up to 0 centimeters.
So oh, wow.
It could actually record right, you know, on top of something, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
Something else I'm going to add in there, though, is, and this kind of gets into the discussions that we've been having about what do you get for the price. Almost all the point-and-shoot cameras have a zoom lens built in, meaning you can go from kind of wide angle to a little bit of a telephoto.
Mm-hmm.
I would think for the kind of shooting that you'd want to do when you're just kind of going into a room and getting an overall picture of the room,
mm-hmm.
you'd want to check on the camera to see how much of a wide angle the camera has.
Okay.
'Cause some of the newer cameras, I've noticed that they haven't had a very wide-angle lens. A lot of times things are talked about in the focal length relative to our old film cameras.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times they'll say it's equivalent to this in a 35-millimeter format. So the easiest way to put that is if they have that 35-millimeter camera equivalency,
mm-hmm.
try to find one that'll go to, you know, 26 millimeters for the wide angle end.
Okay.
Some of them will only go to, you know, 32 millimeter equivalent or 36 or 37 millimeter
mm-hmm.
equivalent. And that's not very wide,
okay.
especially if you're trying to get, you know, show an overall shot of the room
mm-hmm.
before you do those close-up shots.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
All right. Very good. Once again, we'll talk with somebody else in Urbana. This is line three. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I've got a question that goes back a way. I've got an old Vivitar 220 macro lens.
Right.
And the diaphragm linkage doesn't seem to work. Is it possible to get that fixed, and is it worth it?
I guess it would matter if you have a, you know, camera that you like that you still want to use it on, if you still want to shoot film. You know, some of the macro lenses in, you know, in the older days and some of the ones that were not extravagantly priced, they actually didn't have a linkage between the aperture and the camera. So if this is one where you know that it did link with the camera, okay,
mm-hmm.
then, boy, it's a tough call. I mean, you can buy a brand new macro lens for maybe $400. Some of the, you know,
mm-hmm.
like a Tamron or a Vivitar, you might be able to pick up for, you know, a couple hundred dollars.
Mm-hmm.
if you could find someone who will fix it, I'm going to guess it is going to run maybe $70 to $100 to get it fixed.
Might be worth it. It works on my Minolta.
Yeah, and that's it. If it's if it works on a camera that you like and it worked really well when it was working, I would say do it.
It was rated very highly at one time.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like you'd have a good cause to have it fixed.
Yeah. It still is usable because I can shoot it f/2.8, and I use it mostly as a studio camera.
Right. You know, some of them also allowed you to go in, you know, where you could, you know, manually set the aperture, too. So I don't know if it...
Well, I'll have to check that
out.
I don't think so. It's an f/2.8 lens.
Yeah. Yeah, well, give it a try and see what you can find out.
But you think it is possible to get somebody to do it, and it might not go over $100?
If you find the right person, you know, we used to have a few people in town that fix things. I think if you take it to the finish point in town, they have some people, so they'll know where to send it.
Well, that's helpful. That's all helpful information. Thanks.
Okay. Well, great. Thanks very much. There's pretty much where we have to leave it. Just, again, real quick, so you're going out to buy your digital camera. You decide how much you want to spend. There are a number of cameras in that range. You kind of set them side by side. So maybe they all... The megapixels are all pretty much the same. So then you start asking, okay, what's the image sensor?
You know, right.
Maybe they're all the same.
You know, the question I would ask myself before that is, do the controls on this camera make sense to me? You know, because they always have menu structures. And the Canon menu structure worked really well for me. I never liked the Nikon menu structure. Well, the menu structure in Nikon's gotten better. So that's what I would do, is actually try to operate the camera and see if it makes sense to you.
All right. So pick it up, hold it, see
turn
where the
it
buttons
on,
are.
Right.
See,
exactly.
You know, try to figure out what, you know, so to actually see what it would be like to try to use it.
That's it, to actually get in and use it.
Brian Johnson, he's professor of journalism here at the U of I. Thanks very much.
Absolutely.